Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. At what point does life-saving technology become a curse rather than a blessing? As America's population ages, medical science has identified myriad ways to prolong life, but for the sickest patients and their families, at some point, prolonging life can feel more like prolonging death. That was Katie Butler's experience when she became a caregiver for her dying father. A sudden stroke proved to be the beginning of a long and difficult journey through the healthcare system, a journey that raised troubling questions about the nature of healthcare and who ultimately benefits from the system's bias toward longevity. Katie first shared her story in the pages of the New York Times in 2010, and it resonated like few others that year, especially among adult children caring for fragile, sick parents. That story is now available in the form of a memoir entitled Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It is written with the love of a daughter and the tenacity of an investigative journalist. Katie Butler has written about neuroscience, medicine, Buddhism, and human behavior for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vogue, Mother Jones, The Washington Post, and other publications, and she is our guest today on Radio Times. Katie, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's wonderful to be here, Tracy.
So why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote the book because I didn't want other families to go through the unnecessary suffering that my family and especially my parents went through. And because I was a reporter before I became a daughter and a caregiving daughter, I just couldn't rest till I really understood what had happened to us.
Was it difficult for you, Katie, just sort of recounting your father's experience, all the things that happened within your family dynamic during the time of his illness?
Well, yes, in some ways it was, and in some ways it was very healing. In the course of writing the book, I read all of my parents' journals, their letters, their medical reports, and I got a deeper understanding of them in the process of doing that. But there were times when I was writing the book where I was just crying as I wrote it, or just feeling so much sadness for my dad because he was really forced into getting an extra two or three terrible years of life as a result of a really misbegotten, misthought medical procedure, which was to give him a pacemaker after he had already had this terrible stroke.
Let's talk about that, because it seems that that was the beginning of the difficulty, even though having the pacemaker implanted was not such a big deal, but it seems that it brought with it more than anybody bargained for.
Yes, I think we see, what I see now, having done a lot of research, is that when people get into old age where they're quite fragile, things that seem like no-brainers when you're young and vigorous, such as a pacemaker or a major surgery that involves general anesthesia, these things start carrying major, major risks. And the obvious risks are simply the fact that you can get dementia from general anesthesia or an open-heart surgery. And then there are the more subtle moral and emotional risks. And in the case of my dad, this pacemaker, which could have been a totally appropriate intervention for maybe someone younger or someone who still had all their marbles, could be a lifesaver, a miracle thing. For him, because of his condition and his age, we were really not informed that this little device could actually prolong the worst years of his life. And so the only thing he got was a very simple checkbox informed consent form, which just mentioned the risks of minor surgery. Excuse me. But nobody said to us, hey, this could keep him alive longer than he wants to be alive. And nobody said, you know, we could turn this off later if it becomes inappropriate and it's just prolonging his suffering, and you have the right to do that. And nobody said, we have alternatives other than putting in a pacemaker that wouldn't have these long-term consequences. Well, so there was really no informed discussion of the meaning, the moral meaning, the emotional meaning for the family of doing this device that extended his life.
And the pacemaker, Katie, was not so much for a heart issue, right? This was related to a hernia operation.
I know, and again, this is the sort of the subtlety of what happens at this late stage of life, which is that you're treating one thing and then you create a new problem that you hadn't foreseen. So in our particular case, my father had a hernia. He needed a cardiac clearance. The cardiologist would not clear him for the hernia surgery unless he got a pacemaker because he had a slow heartbeat. And the fact is, the slow heartbeat had not created any problems for him health-wise. And so it was really just a just-in-case kind of intervention.
And your family had a primary care doctor, or your parents had a primary care doctor who might have had a different take on that, but wasn't necessarily involved in some of these decisions.
Absolutely. Excuse me. Our family doctor, Dr. Fales, was very against the pacemaker. But because of the way Medicare structures its reimbursements, he would have been paid only $54 to have some very involved conversations with the family and the cardiologist and the surgeon about alternatives. Whereas the pacemaker surgery, which was about $7,500 for the device alone and another $2,500 for the hospital and the surgeon, that was done by Medicare in the blink of an eye with no further questions. So we have a bias in the healthcare system, which is we pay very poorly for human-to-human interactions, and we pay extremely profitably and well for human-to-machine interactions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was one of the lessons that you talked about, that doctors are rewarded for performing more aggressive kinds of treatments as opposed to considering whether these treatments are even necessary.
Well, or appropriate. You know, I think appropriate is really the word. And the profit is not simply, I mean, cardiologists make over $500,000 a year, cardiologists who do interventional procedures, whereas the family doctor may make only $150,000 or $170,000. So you can see the bias right there. But I think it's also that it's not just the doctor, it's the entire medical device industry, which is a mega billion-dollar worldwide industry and very profitable. So all these devices, pacemakers, ventilators, feeding tubes, all these dialysis, hugely profitable, all these devices have industries behind them that are pushing and lobbying Medicare to make sure that they continue to be reimbursed very, very well. And many of them have year-in, year-out profit margins of 20%.
Well, I do remember reading one of the pieces that you wrote saying that, you know, the lobbying by medical device makers, pharma, doctors, hospitals, et cetera, is something like a $545 million a year industry, which has to have an impact on the way healthcare is delivered.
It absolutely does. In 2006, Medicare tried to cut back the amount they paid for some of these questionable devices that are often used close to the end of life. There was a million-dollar lobbying campaign on the Hill with famous celebrities who talked about their wonderful devices and a photo exhibit and a huge campaign, hiring of people who used to work for Ted Kennedy and for Ways and Means. And they mounted an incredibly successful campaign, and they rolled back the attempt to cut back those payments.
Yeah. Katie, what was your dad like before he got sick?
He was a doll. I mean, he was a university professor of history. He loved to teach and loved to argue. He was very healthy. He and my mother were South Africans, and they had all of that kind of immigrant vigor. They had moved to England and then to the U.S. He used to sing to me when I was going to bed at night when I was a kid, and he used to say goodnight to me, quoting Shakespeare, saying, "May choirs of angels sing thee to thy rest." So he taught me to read when I was four. He was, he was like anyone. He was an imperfect person, and he sometimes got angry and mad and was intimidating. But I loved him very, very deeply. And it was just tragic to see someone who loved to argue, who loved to teach, who was definitely the paterfamilias of the family, who ran everything and ran the investments and the savings and the money, and to see him so debilitated And then to, I think many of us will suffer on the way to our deaths. I think of death as a spiritual ordeal, and I don't think we should pretend there's no suffering related with that final phase of life. But when we see this unnecessary suffering added on top of the suffering that's going to occur anyway, that was what really, really bugged me.
Well, and your mother suffered as well, just in her role in caring for your father.
Yes. My mother became a full-time caregiver. She was 77 when my dad had his stroke. She was absolutely devoted to him, and she loved him more than anyone else in the world. And yet, it wore her out. She couldn't sleep. She worried. And then, towards the end of his life, when he was waking a lot at night and falling, she also couldn't get any sleep at night. So it was extremely difficult. And one of the questions I really raise in the book is, what are we doing with our medical system if we give someone some additional years of very debilitated longevity, but the price is paid by the family? So all we've really done is a kind of cost shifting, where the suffering is being moved from the person who's been given the extra years over to the family caregivers. And of course, you know, I loved my father, my mother loved my father, we were honored and absolutely had to do everything we could to help him. But at the same time, the price for both of us was quite high in terms of our own suffering, taking away from other people that we had emotional responsibilities to, taking away, in my case, from my work and my ability to earn money. And I think the voice of the caregiver is really not sufficiently heard. And I think it's also a feminist issue because it's women who do the majority of the caregiving, paid or unpaid. And that work, we give a lot of lip service to how spiritually productive that is and what a blessing it is that people are so saintly, but we don't give them much physical support, financial support, support from institutions like Medicare. Medicare pays very little for nursing, whereas it pays, you know, $35,000, $100,000, $323,000 for things like an ICU death that should never have taken place in ICU.
With just under a minute to go, Katie, the other piece of it is difficult to afford in-home care. So oftentimes, yeah, from my understanding, if you have a sick family member and you want to keep them at home, you're almost on your own unless you can afford what it takes to have someone come in. Was that your experience?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Medicare does provide some very limited in-home nursing help. But mostly the whole system is predicated on the notion that you're going to get cured. So Medicare pays for cure, but it won't pay for care.
Mm. And there's a world of difference between,
yes,
those things.
And I just do want to say, I mean, I think if you get hip to what's going on, you can make this whole process better rather than worse. My mother actually had a very beautiful death, yeah, and a very courageous and honest death. And to me, she's an example of what you can do if you face your death with some bravery instead of trying to put it off forever.
We want to talk about your mother's situation and much more we have to say about your book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler is our guest on Radio Times. We'd love to hear from you as well. Perhaps you are a caregiver. Perhaps you find yourself in a situation like this. We'll take your calls as well when Radio Times comes back.
Enchantment Theater Company supports WHYY and presents its new production, Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales. Aladdin discovers a genie's lamp in a hidden cave. Sinbad sails to distant lands where he rescues an enchanted bird. The Kalandar Prince battles a fiery dragon. Aladdin and Other Enchanting Tales, December 17th through the 30th at Arts Bank Theater on the Avenue of the Arts in Philadelphia. Giant puppets, spellbinding magic, and enchanting music. Ticket information at enchantmenttheater.org.
We asked the National Book Award-winning novelist James McBride to come in for an interview. He asked if he could bring his gospel quintet to play some songs. What were we going to say? No?
It's not my father, it's not my mother, but it's me, oh Lord.
James McBride, musician and author of The Good Lord Bird, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Canada's Postal Service says within 5 years it will end home delivery. Mail will be delivered to communal boxes instead of individual mailboxes. We'll look at that example and ask if the U.S. Postal Service will follow it. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about death. We are talking about the whole notion of prolonging life. And sometimes it becomes an issue of prolonging death. At what point is it too much care? And we've been talking with the author of a new book called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler chronicles the story of her father's own end-of-life journey and the many lessons that she and her mother and her family learned along that journey. We welcome your calls and your comments and questions for Katie as well. The number is 888-477-9499. Maybe you are a caregiver or you've been a caregiver and you know what a difficult situation that is. Perhaps you are a member of the healthcare community. In any case, we would welcome your input into our conversation as well. Katie, you are a science writer. You're a writer by trade. And along the way, in the course of your work, you met a bioethicist who helped bring some clarity to your family situation. What did you learn from her?
Well, I learned a lot that I didn't know. First of all, I simply learned that the pacemaker could be painlessly turned off without any surgery. I also learned...
Katie, are you there? I think we are... All right, we're working on getting Katie back with us, but if you are just joining us, we're talking with Katie Butler. She's the author of a new book. It's called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. And the book chronicles Katie's father's journey, his end-of-life journey that started with a sudden stroke when her father was 79 years of age, and that just led to a host of other things. And her father's life was prolonged by a pacemaker that didn't necessarily have to be inserted, but it was the recommendation of a cardiologist that that be done. And what they found was that as her father began to deteriorate, particularly mentally as well as physically, that that pacemaker was keeping him alive perhaps longer than he wanted to be alive. I believe we have Katie back with us. Katie, are you there?
Yes,
All right.
Sorry, I don't know what happened.
Oh, no worries. So you were telling us...
I'll tell you what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I learned that a long string of Supreme Court decisions and also deep moral and religious inquiry had come up with the position that it is okay for anyone in their right minds to refuse any form of medical treatment and to ask the withdrawal of any medical treatment. This is our human, moral, and legal right. I had no idea. Also, I learned that the pacemaker could be painlessly turned off without surgery, and in fact, the doctors had frequently turned off these devices when they felt it was no longer of benefit for the patient.
And that was quite a dilemma for you, wasn't it? Just the idea of turning off the pacemaker. I mean, you're watching your father deteriorate, you're watching him suffer, but
yes.
There is that ethical question about, is this the right thing to do?
Absolutely. Because my father had said things like, I'm living too long. I'm depressed. I'm living too long.
Mm.
But on the other hand, it was absolutely wrenching and horrible because even though, as I said, we now have worked it out that it's okay to allow a natural death and that everyone has the right to allow a natural death without any artificial interference by medicine, nevertheless, doing something like asking a doctor to turn off my dad's pacemaker, it just felt like murder.
Mm-hmm.
It felt absolutely horrible, even though I knew on a very deep gut level that my mother and I were doing the loving thing and the thing that we thought was morally right.
Yeah.
But that didn't change the way it felt.
Absolutely, because it's difficult to raise that question and not feel like you're doing something very wrong. And yet your work with the bioethicist really kind of helped you work through some of those things.
Well, it helped me clarify where our culture is on this whole issue, that there's like a whole underground, subterranean a group of people who have been doing a great deal of thinking about this, because doctors face this every day in the hospital. Doctors every day are asking families to let people go and to take them off of intensive care equipment. But it's the kind of thing the average person doesn't hear about until they're right in the thick of some terrible family crisis and tragedy. And I really think that's sort of one of the purpose of the books, is we need to get up to speed on this before you're standing at the door of the ICU or the ER with your 94-year-old demented mother trying to decide whether or not to put them on life support or give them a do not resuscitate order, or even do something very simple like say yes or no to antibiotics.
I want to go to the phones, Katie, to Allentown. And Dr. Schwann, welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Dr. Schwann. I'm a cardiac anesthesiologist with a critical care background, and I have two points to make. One is that I think that there are a lot of physicians who do counsel their patients with regards to sort of the big picture, with regards to what a relatively simple procedure like a pacemaker means in a octogenarian elderly patient who's frail. But we frequently find ourselves having that discussion, as the author said, you know, where they've come through a long line of expectations by other subspecialists, and then we sort of tell them something, but this is the real situation, and this is the kinds of things that you have to consider. And a lot of patients are not aware of those implications. So I think there are many physicians who are doing that, but I think that more awareness needs to be promoted with regards to the physicians that are taking care of these elderly and fragile patients. And secondly, I think family members and their ill and their potential providers need to sort of be proactive in thinking about this. Because if you address some of these issues, you know, very systematically, before the patient comes to having that tragic event and then facing a long line of interventions, I think a great deal of confusion can be spared, and I think the process could be made much easier to tolerate for the family and for the patient as well. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Dr. Schwann. Katie, what do you say?
I'm with her all the way. I think, to put it very bluntly, there's a certain amount of blue skying by earlier physicians who will not say to a patient, you are approaching the end of your life. And I think that's a conversation that's really a five-year pathway conversation, not a last minute at the ICU conversation. So what happens is, because earlier doctors have essentially avoided that difficult conversation, then the people like this doctor who are in the intensive care unit find themselves with a family and maybe a family member totally unprepared. And then a doctor they have never met will say to them, I don't think we should do all these interventions. And how are they to have any feeling of trust of this doctor that they have never met? Yeah. So I think it's a two-pronged problem. On the one hand, we as a culture have come to try to avoid even thinking about death because our medicine has been so successful. And on the other hand, their doctors are simply not trained to have these difficult conversations, and when they do have them, they're undercompensated.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Katie, you cited a study in one of the articles that I read by the Dartmouth Atlas Medical Group that talked about how well patients are being informed of the pros and cons of aggressive treatment, and it sounds like maybe not as much as we thought.
Exactly. I was absolutely amazed to find out that I think it's something like a third of patients don't feel they have gotten information about pros, cons, and alternatives to surgery. And I think those are the crucial questions to ask if you're in the doctor's office with your parents or with yourself or your spouse, is what are the pros, what are the cons, and what are the alternatives? And you need to have a very, very clear picture of that before you say yes to anything. I also think it's very important to think in terms of slow medicine, kind of like the slow food movement, when it comes to late life medicine, which is things are rarely as much of an emergency that has to be solved today as it is sometimes framed. And maybe another really crucial phrase is something like, I need a week to think this over, or will you give me a consultation with a palliative care program? that's a wonderful new specialty that really helps people weigh these questions.
Katie, does the research show which way patients tend to go? Those who are lucid, they may be very ill, but can be part of that decision-making process, do they tend to choose aggressive treatments, or do many of them decide they don't want to put themselves through that?
Yes, I think we're all over the map on this as a culture. There are some people who really do want to do everything and are willing to put up with a great deal of suffering, even if they can continue to have life. But about a third of people are not like that. A third of people say they would rather die than be in a nursing home. And a third of people with congestive heart failure, which is very difficult to live with, say they would trade one day of excellent health for another 2 years in their current situation. Mm. So I think what's really important there is that, you know, we are a culture that loves freedom of choice, that we do have freedom of choice. The problem is right now, a lot of us are not getting informed choice. Yeah. And so we're ending up on a pathway to a bad death that we don't even know we're choosing. The doctors know because they've seen a lot of patients, but we don't. You know, 3/4 of people say they want to die at home, but only about 30% of people do die at home, and 1/5 of people die in intensive care. And I have yet to meet anyone who says to me, I want to die plugged into machines and unable to give anybody my final blessings or my last words.
We'll go back to the phones to Phoenixville and Carlton. Welcome, Carlton, to Radio Times.
Good morning. This is just such a privilege to be able to speak to you today. And my comment is about my work as a massage therapist and witnessing such a beautiful passing of a woman in the Phoenixville community through Rudolf Steiner's work. And I was introduced to a book called Living Through Dying by Nancy Porter, who's from Sacramento, who's part of the Waldorf teaching and education Rudolf Steiner community. I was there because my daughter was graduating from the Rudolf Steiner College in Sacramento. And I was so moved by the beauty of this woman passing in our community. And when I read the book, Living Through Dying, and I spoke to Nancy Porter, she said, Carlton, if you could just get the message out of what the choices are.
Yeah.
And so that's my comment, is Rudolf Steiner's work is addressing part of what you are talking about today. And yeah. I just, you know, I can take the comment off the air, but I just was so moved and such a privilege to hear you speak today, because this is my life work, has been for the last 25 years working with people passing. So I'm thrilled to hear you speak today. Thank you.
Yes, I think the point there is that we have transformed death from a spiritual ordeal into a technological flail. And we've lost touch with a lot of deep Western traditions about how to die. There were books in the 1400s with titles like Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying. And those books were very, very current all through the 1800s. They really helped guide people through the dying process. And as the caller said, there are a number of books out there now. There's another one called Sacred Dying to really help people bring back forms of spiritual ritual around the dying process that make sense for them. Because a lot of people, even if they no longer have a formal religious practice, they still yearn for a sense of the sacred in this most amazing final passage of our lives.
We'll go back to the phones to Ardmore and Kate. Hi, Kate. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to share some information with you. Dad died at the age of 88 a couple months ago. He had colon cancer, stage 4. We had a wonderful experience with hospice. They are living angels. We had a great oncologist for him who was very upfront, told him his options, and Dad decided he just wanted to deal with what he had and deal with hospice. The only negative physicians that we had, he was referred to a geriatric psychiatrist. And all they did for about 2 months was just constantly, because he was depressed, but just kept putting him on more drugs and more drugs, and all he wanted to do is sleep. And he lost he lost a couple months in a stupor, which probably was so unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally said we're not going there anymore, and he decided he didn't want to either. And he ended up with hospice, which again I said was couldn't have been more wonderful. And he died at home, surrounded by family.
Wow.
Mm. Kate, thank you for sharing that with us. Kate, a couple of interesting points there, particularly the depression piece of it.
Yes, I'm just struck by how we want to frame all suffering as mental illness or depression or pathology, that maybe it's very appropriate for someone approaching their end of their lives to feel remorse, regret that they have to leave the world, sorrow. A lot of very, very human emotions, and, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, so who knows in terms of this particular person, but that's what really, really strikes me here. It's almost like we want to turn ourselves into consumers even on the deathbed, or the culture wants to turn us into consumers, and maybe we have real spiritual tasks at the end of life, and we need to not pathologize them.
Yeah. I'm going to squeeze in one last call. We may have to do the answer on the other side of the break, but we'll go to Jenkintown and Julie. Welcome, Julie, to Radio Times.
Hi. I really appreciate this conversation, and I can't wait to read your book. I, too, am a massage therapist who specializes in oncology and end-of-life care, and I work in both private practice and in a hospital, and I'm always struck with how this conversation really doesn't take place very easily. And I recently took a wonderful end-of-life care class for caregivers, and which I also am with my mom, towards the end of her life, and we discussed the work, which is called Five Wishes, and my question is whether or not you use Five Wishes and offer that to people. It's really quite an extensive, almost like pamphlet of how you can go through for yourself and also with your loved ones to talk about how you want to go through the end of your life if you actually have that opportunity. So thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation.
Thanks, Julie, for your call. Katie, are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with it. I confess that it is not one of the areas that I looked into, but I have heard very, very good things about it repeatedly. There are a number of resources out there. Five Wishes, there's something called the Conversation Project. If you go on to palliative care websites for the national organizations, you will see places you can download documents that are very, very important for signing before you reach the end of your life. So there's a huge research. It's wonderful to have Five Wishes mentioned.
Well, and oftentimes, people just need a way to start that conversation, because as you pointed out, it's a conversation people don't want to have, but perhaps with some guidance or maybe a different way to think through it, that can help kind of get the ball rolling.
Yes, and in my family, I found it really important. After my father had his stroke, I started writing him what I called legacy letters. And I didn't say, hey, Dad, you know, you're approaching the end of your life now. Let's have a discussion. What I said was, these are the things that are your legacy to me, that I'm always going to remember. How you taught me to read. How you taught me to swim. So I think we need to start the emotional work before we start talking about the pieces of paper.
Katie, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back with more, plus your questions and comments when Radio Times returns.
Supporting WHYY, Kevin O'Brien Studio, with fabrics made by hand in Philadelphia. This year's Kevin O'Brien Sample Show is at 17 North 3rd Street, offering curtains, scarves, pillows, and bedding. More details at kevinobrienstudio.com.
Hang me, oh, hang me.
On the next Fresh Air, Joel and Ethan Coen talk about their new movie Inside Llewyn Davis, about a folk singer in Greenwich Village in 1961. The Coen brothers also made O Brother, Where Art Thou, The Big Lebowski, and True Grit. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The modern criminal investigation. Somebody just made it all up.
Sherlock was the beginning of all the enthusiasm, getting people interested in using science, investigating.
Hey, Sherlock, the imaginary Mr. Holmes is the brains behind crime solving even today. It's anything but elementary. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Many of the main lines supports WHYY, featuring the full line of the fuel-efficient, design-for-fun Mini. Located less than 5 miles from the Philadelphia Art Museum at 130 Montgomery Avenue in Bala-Cynwyd, and online at minimainline.com.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about this question: at what point does life-saving medical technology become a curse rather than a blessing? That's one of the questions raised in a new book by Katie Butler. It's called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death, and it is the story of primarily of Katie's father and his end-of-life journey and the challenges that she and the rest of her family, including her father, encountered on that journey, some of the lessons learned. We welcome your calls with your comments or questions as well at 888-477-9499. Katie, what about a living will? How does that fit into this conversation?
A living will is important. It essentially is legally called an advance directive, and it lays out what kind of interventions you do or don't want. However, a number of them are kind of boilerplate that hasn't changed much in a couple decades, and therefore it's limited to if you're comatose or within 6 months of dying. But, for example, my father had dementia, and he also had a pacemaker, and neither that tiny little device nor his mental condition were really addressed. So I think it's important to tailor make it to your own beliefs and your own fears about the future. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I don't want my life prolonged if I have dementia, because I know how much the people around me will suffer, not just me. And so I want to make it really clear that if I have dementia, I want comfort care only, and I want everyone to allow a natural death.
Katie, does that advance directive ever clash with the sort of propensity toward life, as we talked about earlier, that, you know, in a hospital setting, in an ICU, it's about extending life.
Yeah.
So what do you have to do to make sure that your wishes are honored in that case?
Yeah, unfortunately, they are often ignored or even ripped out of a chart. That's happened. I think probably what's more important is appointing what's called a medical proxy, someone to speak for you who loves you and knows you very well when you can't speak for yourself. Also, there are another set of documents called POLST, which is Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, and these are actually signed by another doctor, and so they're taken much more seriously in a hospital. And these can be anything from do not intubate to do not transport. In other words, do not take this person out of the nursing home and put them in the hospital, you know. Do not hydrate. Do not use antibiotics. So, and these forms are very, very bright pink, so they're easy for other doctors to see.
And is that something that someone could access online or through their family care doctor, or how does that?
You can access online if you Google POLST and the name of your state. You will probably come up with something that can help you.
We'll go back to the phones to Ben Salem and Anthony. Welcome, Anthony, to Radio Times.
Hello. What a wonderful program this morning. And I'm kind of giving you a family's perspective. We're not clinical people, but we went through this whole experience with my mother about 6 years ago. But the nice thing about it, I told your screener, is it came from her. She decided she has been too much pain. Her body was wearing out. She knew that. She had been on dialysis for over 6 years. A little bit of dementia. My father was a full-time caregiver, but I'm one of nine, so she had a large, loving family, 17, 18 grandchildren, a couple great-grandchildren. But she knew it was the end of her life. But like your guest had said, the doctors never said, you know, you need to make this decision, because they were more than happy to keep up with the dialysis and the various episodes of going into the hospital for different problems. But she said, call the kids, I'm done. And, you know, 6 years now removed from it, you know, I look back on it, what a wonderful life-ending experience for all of us. It was obviously very difficult to let her go, but we all got to say goodbye. The grandchildren all got to say bye to Grandma. It was difficult for my father, but, you know, all our energy and resources turned over to him to support him. And like I said, I'll never forget what she told my father. He says, call the kids, it's time for me to go. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to, you know, share with your listeners today, that it's, we knew it was coming, it's just a process, and I think the families have to really be aggressive on that end, because as your speakers have said, a lot of the doctors and clinical people aren't comfortable with it. And, you know, we do have a couple of clinical people in our family, so we were educated in some of the things that are out there and available. So that's what I want to bring to your program today.
Well, thank you, Anthony, for sharing your family story with us. Katie, what do you say? It sounds similar to perhaps your mom's experience.
In a way, it's just such a beautiful story, because I think it reminds us that one of the most important legacies we can leave our children is that they are not traumatized by the nature of our dying. And deaths in ICU are very traumatic to the surviving family members. So even though we're dying and we may feel helpless, actually, like this mom who just was on the caller was just describing, there's actually tremendous gifts you can give your children, gifts of honesty, realism, generosity, giving them your blessings. Just a beautiful story. My mother was offered open-heart surgery at the age of 84 to fix two leaky heart valves, and because it had a major risk of stroke or dementia, she said no. And that allowed her to do very similar things with us. She actually came home from refusing surgery, cleaned out the basement, told somebody that she wasn't planning to leave a mess for her kids. She made peace with one of my brothers. She had some very moving conversations with me where she really gave me her blessing for my relationship with the man that I love, and where she actually apologized for me for a very minor kind of slight that she had done. Mm-hmm. So she really got a chance to do these end-of-life tasks of, you know, thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye, because she was so brave and so willing to accept the reality of her coming dying. It was a wonderful opportunity for all of us. And she had to be very brave. I mean, there were about three or four different sets of cardiologists who tried to persuade her to change her mind because she was so healthy in other ways. But she was very, very clear, and she really ended up with the death that she wanted and the death that had meaning for her, not the death that had meaning for someone else.
Mm, there's a powerful lesson there.
Oh, yeah.
We'll go to South Jersey next, and Sheila. Welcome, Sheila, to Radio Times.
Yes, hello. It's a great show, and I had just watched Forks Over Knives last night. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but anyway, just coming, waking up this morning and hearing this program, it just brings everything together. My question was that the pacemaker and the whole idea that in order for your father, who was relatively healthy at the time, as you said, in order for him to get this treatment, he was actually going to have to be forced to get a pacemaker. I was wondering, that was the diagnosis of the anesthesiologist. Were you able to check with other anesthesiologists? Because I almost feel that it was a liability issue. Oh, I don't want to operate because something can go wrong because he had a slow heart rate. And I guess
absolutely.
I was thinking, was there another way you could have gone and still gotten hernia surgery without the pacemaker being involved at all?
Absolutely, but of course, at the time, we weren't informed enough to make all those type of phone calls that you're talking about. But of course, in retrospect, I learned, A, the surgery could have been done using a local anesthetic rather than a general. It would have had to have been done a different way, but that would have been an option. B, we could have had a temporary pacemaker hooked up for the time of the surgery and the recovery room time, and then it could have been just disconnected and never put inside his body. Or three, as you point out, the liability issues I really think are part of what is driving the fear of doctors, and so that they keep offering interventions because they're afraid if they don't offer everything, maybe someday some angry, you know, child is going to come back and say, I'm suing you for medical neglect and for not doing, you know, reaching the standard of care in your community. So unfortunately, it requires family members who are in the middle of a crisis that's emotional and personal to also be very proactive and on top of things and very educated.
We'll go next to Wayne, Pennsylvania, and Mary. Welcome, Mary, to Radio Times.
Hi. My sister was an angel taking care of my mother who got dementia after my father passed away. We thought maybe he might have covered for her for a number of years anyway. And after about 10 years of taking care of her in the home, if, you know, she had the shower redone and all that, she could walk in, she just said, I'm done. Mom's 95. I just can't do it anymore. Of course, her own husband had contracted cancer, and but he was in remission, but on an oxygen tank from smoking and all. But that's another story. So she was in my, and also she couldn't have any hospice care because she was way out in the country, you know, way, way out in farmland in lower New York State. And she went into a village in New York State where my niece lived, and she had an extra guest room. So she was able to get help and get the hospice. But, you know, eventually my mom just stopped eating. I think on a certain level she knew it wasn't my sister. She couldn't vocalize or say anything about that. I mean, she did talk, but very little, you know. But at that point, she just shut down. And I put on a, there was a torture lamp. I couldn't light a candle, but I knew it was near the end. And I'm sorry, but, and it's already been 5 or 6 years, but I was able to put on this beautiful, I happen to have this matriarch, it was called Matriarch, two Indian, American Indian women chanting. And I put that on. She passed to that one. It was the most beautiful death, you know, to have it. And I kind of felt that I would have loved to have, I felt like the village women should be around and just wrap her in white sheets, but we couldn't. My sister said, okay, we have to call, you know, the funeral parlor, get the body out. I don't want my grandchildren seeing this in the morning and that. But I could see where the, all those traditions from ancient times really gave a finality and a goodbye, you know. But it was a beautiful ending for her. Sorry, I'm breaking up.
Thank you, Mary. What a beautiful story. Katie?
Yes, this is absolutely beautiful. It makes me think of my great-grandfather's death. You know, he died suddenly at the age of 65. His body was brought back to the house. It was laid in the family parlor. They put flowers all around, and they had 3 days of visiting. This was before the days of funeral homes, really. And I agree, we need to bring beauty into the ceremony of dying, and we will all bring forms that make sense for us. I'm keeping up a tradition now called the Yahrzeit candle, which is a Jewish tradition, where on the day of the death, you light a candle that burns for 24 hours, and I put up pictures of my parents, flowers, and I remember them. And I think it really helps, and we need to re-remember all of these traditions or make up our own.
Let's see if we can get in another call from Morristown, New Jersey. Dr. Nitti, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I've worked in nursing facilities for about 10 years. Lo and behold, within the last year, my mother has developed dementia. And all of these issues that your author speaker is talking about just resonate so much with me. Physicians who don't deal with the emotional aspect of their patients' death and dying experience. Families who aren't navigated well through the system and don't have advocates. You know, the care of the individual in their home. And the whole spiritual aspect of the death experience. So these are the issues that really resonate with me, and I commend you for the conversation this afternoon.
Thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, I have a thought here I just want to throw in, which is we need to triple the hospice benefit. I mean, that mother of the prior caller was unable to get hospice care because she was too far in the country. We need to triple the daily payment for hospice benefits so that anyone can get hospice anywhere and they can get more home nursing care as part of the hospice benefit than we get right now.
Yeah. Katie?
Also, I want to say something about nursing homes. Like, a lot of nursing homes have policies that if someone dies, they're automatically, they call 911 and the person is put through resuscitation. Or if they fall, they're automatically, again, the ER, you know, the ambulance is called and they're taken to the ER where they may spend hours and be put through a lot of unnecessary testing and then sent home after having generated a lot of payments that Medicare has to pay. And I'm just wondering about that. I hope sometime nursing homes will re-examine these policies because they really just create suffering in that final year or two of life. Hmm.
Katie, what advice do you have for people who find themselves in the position that you were in with your father or with your mother, for that matter, who find themselves sort of trying to navigate all of this and not quite sure how to get through it?
Wow. Well, I mean, I hate to say this, but I do think the book, which is Knocking on Heaven's Door, really does provide a map for this whole very complex territory. And I would say one of the most important things is to listen to your gut, because you love and know your parent, and you know them a lot better than any of these doctors. Number two is to understand that there is a bias in the medical system towards maximum longevity, no matter what quality of life. And number three would be to get access to a palliative care program as soon as you can. Palliative care is somewhat like hospice in that it really focuses on quality of life and controlling symptoms, but palliative care does not require you to stop all attempts at cure. So it's a little looser of a system, and the palliative care doctors I have met have just been amazing. And then finally, I think we really need a grassroots movement to change the way Medicare reimburses so that we reimburse better for care and not so much for cure when cure is no longer a realistic possibility.
Katie, very quickly, one of our callers wants to repeat the information on getting the physician forms. Was it POLST?
Yes. That's right. It's Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, and that is POLST.
All right. So you Google that, look for your state, and that's where you'll get information on those forms. The book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler, thank you for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Tracy. This was a wonderful, wonderful hour, and I appreciate all your callers.
Our producers today have been Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski, and I'm Tracy Matysak, filling in for Marty Moscone.